From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. It's not easy for someone who is deaf or has another disability to rise to the top of their profession. Dr. Jane Fernandez was born deaf and is now the provost and vice chancellor at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. She's also an advocate for the deaf and is involved in white privilege issues. I had a chance to talk with her during her visit to UW La Crosse this week. An American Sign Language interpreter communicated my questions to her.
I was born deaf. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. And my mother was also born deaf. And one of my brothers was born hard of hearing. And he became deaf over the course of his lifetime. And then I have three brothers who are hearing, and my father is hearing. So I grew up in a mixed deaf, hard of hearing, and hearing family. And I saw pretty early on that there are really two different sets of rules. The world works differently. It works one way for people with hearing, and it works a different way for people who are deaf. I was raised to speak English and speech read English. And I didn't learn American Sign Language until I was in graduate school at the University of Iowa.
Wow.
Yes.
So how did you communicate with your mother or your father, regardless if people could hear or could not hear?
We communicated through speech and speech reading. A great deal of time and energy, money, resources were devoted by my parents to help me learn how to be able to speech read and write English. They actually hired a speech teacher who had been my mother's speech teacher, and she came to live with them. And so a lot of time was put into that, but we communicated with English at home.
So can you explain, at what age did you begin to be able to speak, and can you remember that moment?
I can't really remember the moment, but I can remember doing a lot of work and not speaking very clearly. I can remember that. I remember trying hard to make myself understood and people not understanding me. Actually, we have some tapes from when I was growing up, which I can't hear them, but I'm told that it shows pretty clearly when I started, I was pretty much unintelligible. And then each year, things started to get clearer and clearer until eventually I could speak fairly well.
I would imagine with a family with people who can hear, people who are deaf, that the dinner table is probably pretty dynamic.
Really interesting, yes. Okay, so really what happened, the most amazing thing, yes. The hearing people had one conversation with the verbal communication, verbal language. And my mother and my brother and I were having another conversation, but we had no voice. So we actually spoke without voice at the table and carried on a whole conversation. So two different parallel worlds going on at the dinner table. Sometimes.
Sure. When you were going to school, elementary, middle, high school, were you in a deaf school or were you in a school with other children who could hear?
I always went to a public school. And my parents paid for the teacher who worked with me at home as a major source of support to help me through the public school. Because back then, there were no requirements for accommodations to be made in schools.
Wow. So that must have been, financially, it's just an extra finance for the family too. But, were teachers accommodating then? Has it gotten better today, do you think?
I will say all of my teachers tried their best. Many of them just didn't know what to do. But everyone was well-intentioned. They all tried. But I think today the situation is vastly improved due to state and federal laws and regulations that require accommodations to be made for students with disabilities. So I'm quite sure things are much, much, much better now for deaf students.
When you were in graduate school, you said, that's when you finally learned American Sign Language. Can you take us back to that moment when you decided, oh, this is something that I want to learn?
My roommate, I lived in an apartment. She was learning American Sign Language in a class. I was not actually learning American Sign Language, but she was learning. And for her class, she had an assignment to go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to a deaf club. She was very nervous about doing that because she felt she wouldn't understand anything. So she asked me if I would go with her, not because I'm deaf, just to help her.
Sure, it's always easy to have a friend with you.
Just to be a friend. And so I agreed, and we went to the deaf club, and I think I'm pretty sure that was the moment that transformed my understanding of what it means to be a deaf person. Because I walked into the room, and there were 300 deaf people. That's more deaf people I'd ever seen in one place in my entire life. 300 deaf people, and all were signing. And I found that at least halfway I could understand them, and they could understand me, even though I didn't know sign language, because we both basically were people who struggle all the time to understand, and we have strategies for understanding things that we don't understand.
How so?
I'm not sure if I can explain. Just something that happens when you're born deaf. You spend a life trying to figure out things that make no sense to you. And over time, you develop an inner sense of how to make sense of these things.
So how long, then, did it take you to learn American Sign Language?
I'd say I'm still learning ASL. It's not an easy thing to learn, and the process is probably the same as learning any foreign language, a foreign language for a hearing person. So if a hearing person decided to learn German at the age of 23, how well would we really expect them to learn it?
Right, your brain isn't, it's easier to learn when you're younger.
Yes, it would have been much better if I learned ASL when I was younger, at ages where the brain is primed to learn languages. But I did dive into it. I put everything I had into it. I immersed myself. And the Iowa Deaf community was wonderful to me. So they invited me almost every weekend. After that, I rode a bus to different towns in Iowa. I stayed with different deaf families. And they really put themselves into trying to help me understand my deaf identity with good success.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Jane Fernandez. She's the Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at University of North Carolina, Asheville. She's speaking this week on the UWL campus about the deaf community and also about white privilege. Can you talk about the difference that it made within your life, not only professionally, but personally, once you did become more fluent in ASL?
When I learned American Sign Language and I started to learn about deaf culture and actually to make that my language and my culture, my identity as a person became more complete. I learned things that were part of me, but I never had words for them. I learned that with ASL, so many things that I couldn't have access to, with ASL I had access to them. I learned in graduate school that I could have interpreters in my graduate classes. And when I had interpreters, I actually could follow the conversation in my classes. I made my life much more rich and complete. So I'm eternally grateful that I had the good fortune to be asked to go to the Cedar Rapids Deaf Club with my roommate back then.
So when you say that there were words that you found that kind of made you feel more complete, was it more like emotional words? Because you do hear other people say that about many foreign languages. You know, in Spanish, there are words that describe emotions that we don't necessarily have in English.
I think it is the same sense in English of, on some level, in many ways, as a deaf person, up until the time I learned ASL and deaf culture, I was a successful person. I'd done well in school. I had competed in different sports. I was in graduate school. No matter what happened, I was going to have a successful job. I was on my way. But on a personal level, I would say I always felt half complete. My glass was half full. And when I learned ASL and deaf culture, my glass was full. You know, I had everything. I knew who I was. I knew what I could be. And I was more in charge of the decisions I was making.
Did your family then learn ASL eventually, other members of your family?
Well, my mother tried to learn, but she's 22 years older than I am, and so it was a challenge for her, and eventually she didn't continue. My brother never learned, my deaf brother never learned sign language. My brother has a deaf niece, has a deaf daughter, my niece. She doesn't sign. Both of my parents understood very clearly that learning ASL and deaf culture gave me something that was essential to my being. And they could see that in me, their daughter, and they were happy for me.
What was it that you studied in undergraduate and in graduate school that got you to where you are professionally?
I studied a lot of things. But for example, I studied French literature. I studied Italian literature. In graduate school, I made a special request, and my request was granted to be allowed to study American Sign Language as an academic subject. And to eventually, I got permission to do my dissertation about American Sign Language storytelling in Iowa as a form of unwritten literature. And probably that work is what led me to start working at universities, and then eventually to be in the position I have today at UNC Asheville.
Would you say you are an advocate for the deaf community through your research and through what you've gone through in the different educational institutes?
I am an advocate for improving access to information, education, and opportunity for deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people. Yes.
So you said that education for younger students has definitely improved since your time. But can you paint the picture of what access is like for students who are deaf and the biggest challenges that they face today?
The biggest challenge deaf students face today is probably not that different than it has ever been. And that is when a child is born deaf, parents ask, how will my child learn? How will my child learn how to speak? How will my child learn how to read? Where will my child go to school? How will my child have friends? How will I, my child's mother, how will I talk to my own child? Those are basic human questions which cause profound soul-searching for any deaf child.
Within the educational system, do you feel like there are more greater strides? Because does it come down to having an interpreter on hand? Or are there other things within schools that they can be doing?
Well, there are a lot of things that schools can be doing and should be doing. One would be to give deaf children access to teachers who use sign language fluently, and that would obviate the need to use an interpreter. The other one is to train interpreters to work in educational settings and to put more time and more resources into creating interpreters that are qualified to work in different levels of education. So elementary deaf children, middle school deaf children, high school deaf children would have a developmental approach to working with someone who is interpreting for them, upon whom they are depending for all information. There are other accommodations that can be made in terms of technology. So there's captioning for TV or captioning for DVDs. There is all kinds of, the leveling of the playing field that happens with online, with iPads, with text messages and video relay services, all kinds of access that's provided. And then there are higher quality hearing aids, and there are cochlear implants that many parents are opting to choose for their children.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Jane Fernandez. She's the Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at University of North Carolina in Asheville. She is speaking on UWL's campus this week about the deaf community, and also she's tackling white privilege. I'm wondering if you can talk about white privilege. UW-La Crosse, for many years, has incorporated the concept into its curriculum and many of its classes. But to people who aren't familiar with the idea, I think sometimes when they first hear about white privilege, comes across as a little abrasive. So I'm hoping you can help people kind of understand what exactly white privilege is.
My work on white privilege is focused on higher education. So maybe I could talk a little bit about that. But white privilege is a system in place in society and grants unearned privileges to people based on their skin color. Privileges include access to information, resources, power, and benefits. It's hard for a lot of people to talk about because a lot of white people don't really think that they have any privileges. I can say that for higher education, for example, as a white person, when I take a class in human civilization, I am confident that people of my color will be the people who have made human civilization what it is today. I can be sure when I send my own children to college that the curriculum they study will testify to the existence of their race. My children will never feel left out or made to feel that they didn't have an important part in the history of humanity. I can say that my university bookstore will carry food, snack food, staple foods that fit with my culture, and that the bookstore will have hair products and makeup that I can use. If I need them in a pinch, I can run to the bookstore and get some things to do my hair and makeup. I would never have to worry about that. I can say that at universities, 90% of the senior leadership positions in higher education are held by white people. And 90% of the tenured faculty at universities throughout the nation are white people. Students who apply to college are white students are 2 times more likely to be admitted to the college of their first choice. And white students are 2 times more likely to fail admissions criteria, but to be admitted anyway at a university based on parental status or alumni status or status in relation to someone who has given money to the university. So these are just a few examples of the ways that white privilege exists in higher education. And I do a lot of work with white privilege and what I call audism or hearing privilege, and the two systems intersecting.
How so?
Maybe you should explain a little bit about the word audism. It's not autism. It's different.
A-U-D?
Thank you. A-A-U-D-I-S-M. Audism is a system that gives advantages to people who can hear normally. Especially in my work at Gallaudet University, which is a university for deaf students in Washington, D.C., I saw how white deaf people had access within the context of Gallaudet University, had access to all the privileges afforded to white people. And white deaf people oppressed deaf people of color. The system at Gallaudet University oppressed people of color in the same ways that I just described as applied to hearing institutions of higher education in general.
People shouldn't be naive to think that systems of oppression aren't necessarily throughout the entire system. They go on throughout different communities too.
They happen both in communities and they happen personally. Between individuals, they happen in communities, and they happen at a big picture level.
Does it come down to educating people about privilege, whether it's white privilege, whether it's hearing privilege? I mean, does it just take knowledge for people to start understanding and maybe breaking down these barriers? Or what exactly is your philosophy on that concept?
In my work, I advocate for examining and transforming the structures that are in place that hold privileged systems and continue them. So I advocate, for example, examining admissions policies, and for the university administration to examine how admissions policies and admissions practices may be reinforced or may reinforce privilege of white applicants. And then universities making a decision that they will be equitable and just in all admissions decisions. So I advocate that the more we know about how the systems work, the better we'll be able to examine them and transform them into the reflections of socially just institutions that we want to be.
Some people may say, well, aren't there, with affirmative action, doesn't that help out people who maybe aren't as privileged? I mean, what's your experience with that within higher education?
I'm not an expert on affirmative action, and I suspect that affirmative action may have helped a few people.
But not an entire system.
The statistics I gave you apply to the whole system would not seem to imply with 90% of the senior leadership as white people, 90% of the tenured faculty white people, with the admissions rates that we have of white students, does not seem to apply that affirmative action is granting, maybe making a few individual decisions that help to support individual people, but I don't know if it's helping the entire system.
How has your work and sort of the goals that you have you noticed a difference at University of North Carolina, Asheville, or any of the other schools that you've worked at? Have you seen a change within the system because of your work?
I've seen changes in my work at UNC Asheville in specific departments. So if I work with the admissions office, I see improvement there. If I work with a specific academic department, I see improvement there. And we still have more work to do on university-wide processes that would actually transform the university into the socially just institution we want to be. But I do see progress, yes.
So when people come and see you talk, what is it that you hope either students, faculty and staff, or even just community members who are interested in what you have to say, what do you hope that everyone takes away?
Well, I hope they learn that the system of white privilege and hearing privilege were put into place by our ancestors to benefit us, but they are not impermeable. And knowing what the systems look like and what they do allows us to examine them and transform them. And if each one of us takes steps to take down or change some of the policies and the practices we have in place, we can make progress and see a more socially just university.
Dr. Jane Fernandez is a college administrator at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. Deaf since birth, she's an advocate for the deaf community and works to reduce white privilege. She spoke this week at UW La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, photos, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.